Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday morning. It's June 23rd. Currently 65 degrees here in Old Town Park City with some smoky skies. 62 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Tuesday. Yes, you guessed it. More of that smoke and haze will be lofted well up into the air as we go throughout today. So just get ready for more smoky and hazy skies. And yes, that will do a number on the air quality. So as you get into the lower elevations of the Wasatch back, you're likely going to be dealing with some of that code orange, unhealthy for sensitive group air quality. Meanwhile, if you get a little higher up in elevation, as typical this time of the year, things will improve a little bit. But still, smoky and hazy skies expected, but they do make for those very vibrant sunsets. So that's something to look forward to. Otherwise, high temperatures, very summer-like out there for us. We'll be climbing into the upper 80s for highs in the Park City area today, with highs in the low 90s for us. And the Heber Valley could actually flirt with the low to mid 90s in the Heber Valley. Now, as we make our way into your Wednesday, we're going to be seeing that sunshine that's going to be sticking around across the area. Temperatures will be into the 80s for Park City for highs. We'll be back into the low 90s for highs in the Heber Valley. Now, Thursday, we're going to try to get a little moisture in here, really Wednesday and Thursday. So both days, there will be a chance of a couple of isolated pop-up storms. Now, the primary threat is not going to be heavy rainfall or flash flooding with these. It's going to be more of those dry thunderstorms. So gusty, damaging winds and the potential of lightning will be the primary threat. We do actually have a marginal, that's a low-end risk, but a 1 out of 5 risk for a strong to severe storm with, again, damaging winds being the primary threat. Again, it will be isolated in nature, but there is a chance. So we do want you to be aware of that if you're going to be recreating out and about across the area as we go throughout your Wednesday and Thursday afternoons. Now, once that system moves through, we're going to see one more pretty warm day for us on Friday with highs in the mid-80s. In Park City with highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. Then we've got a cold front, a strong cold front moving through for the weekend. High temperatures drop into the 70s in Park City Saturday, 60s for highs on Sunday. Highs go from the 80s in the Heber Valley to the low 70s by Sunday. Get ready for the cool down. That's to get your latest forecast for the Wasatch back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up on the Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott, taking a look at the agenda for tomorrow's County Council meeting. And from the Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History, Board Members Alicia O'Meara and Don Roll with details about the Music for the Mines fundraiser next week and how that money will be spent. Park City Golf Director Vaughn Robinson will be in with details on an upcoming open house to look at the course's proposed new master plan. Well, it is primary election day, and Summit County Republicans will nominate candidates to state and federal House seats today. Democrats will vote for members of the Summit County Council. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on when and where.
Summit County's 4 in-person polling locations for the 2026 primary election open at 7 a.m. Tuesday. Voters can also drop their mail-in ballot at one of the county's drop boxes or any polling location. Polls and drop boxes close at 8 p.m. Republicans across Summit County will nominate either Phil Lyman, a former state House representative and gubernatorial hopeful, or incumbent Celeste Malloy for the U.S. House District 3 race. In Summit County, Utah House District 59 only includes Park City proper and part of the Snyderville Basin. Political newcomer Jeffrey Pierce and Wasatch County Council member Luke Searle are vying for the GOP nomination in that district, which also includes Wasatch County. Only Democrats have announced runs for the 2 Summit County Council seats on the ballot this year, Districts 4 and 5. Lawyer Christy Babalis and former Planning Commissioner John Kuchera are running in District 4 for the Central Snyderville Basin. In District 5, the Jeremy Ranch area, incumbent Candace Hart and Park City School Board member Meredith Reed are the candidates. Polls are located at Colville City Hall, the Camas Library, the Quinns Junction Health Department Building, and the Kimball Junction Library. Summit County also has 11 ballot drop boxes. Some are located at the Jeremy Ranch Park and Ride, Kimball Junction Library, Camas's Library, and other East Side City Halls. A full list is at kpcw.org. Ballots sent through the mail must arrive at the county clerk's office by 8 p.m. June 23rd to be counted. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
And voters in Wasatch County can also cast their primary ballots today. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more on what to know about primary day?
Ballot processing is underway for the 2026 primary elections in Wasatch County, when voters will choose Republican candidates for federal, state, and local races. There are no Democratic primary races in Wasatch County this year. In-person voting is available from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Tuesday at the County Administration Building in Heber City. Residents can also deposit their ballots in drop boxes around the county, including the county building and the library. There are also boxes at city halls in Charleston, Hideout, Midway, and Wallsburg. All drop boxes close promptly at 8 p.m. Ballots can also be delivered to the polling place. At the county level, Republicans will make their picks for sheriff, clerk, auditor, and one at-large council seat. Incumbent Sheriff Jared Rigby is seeking a third term in the role. His challenger is Jeremy Hales, the county's director of emergency management. Summit County Detective Eric Maynard's name appears on the ballot, but votes for him will not be counted. He withdrew from the race May 27th. In the clerk auditor race, Park City Recorder Michelle Kellogg seeks to unseat incumbent Joey Granger, who's been in the office since 2020. Rachel Kaler and William Vance, known as Brett, are running for an at-large county council seat. Parkite and political newcomer Jeffrey Pierce is facing Wasatch County Councilmember Luke Searle for the Republican candidacy for Utah House District 59. And Phil Lyman and Celeste Malloy are the Republicans on the ballot for U.S. House District 3. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, this morning at 10 o'clock, Summit County Manager Shane Scott will possibly approve the first amendment to the Administrative Development Agreement for Park City Junction. He joins me now in the studio to tell us more about that, as well as preview tomorrow's County Council meeting. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, Leslie. So
what is it that you're being asked to approve later today? I mean, I'm confused. Park City Junction is not Junction Commons, right?
Right, yes. Junction Commons is being addressed, though, tomorrow at Council. But this is the development agreement amendment with Six Ridge Partners over the public-private partnership. And the real crux of this amendment is to accommodate up to 50,000 new square feet to accommodate three buildings. And we did have a public meeting about this. I think KPCW covered very well. And I will have that on my desk this morning. The proposal that I have read, the latest draft, does accommodate those three buildings for three different possible uses. It's not three buildings. It's 50,000 square feet. It's one new building, and then it's accommodating two 10,000 square foot spaces in two existing buildings.
Yeah. So this is all for nonprofit space?
Yes, it would accommodate the Kimball Arts Center. It has been public about their desire to move from Park City to this area. They would have a building up to 30,000 square feet just west of the Peak Building, which is the old Skullcandy Building that the county now owns and is going through a process to improve. And then the other 10,000 square foot spaces could accommodate some nonprofits. I think one way or the other, they will accommodate a community benefit space. It won't be for retail, it won't be for commercial, it won't be housing. It'll be some sort of a community benefit.
Okay, and is that in the development agreement, that it can't be used for commercial purposes?
It doesn't say it that way, but it does leave the county in control of what is in that space. So the county could dictate. And I guess in theory it could be a commercial space, but the county would have to make that determination at a later date.
Yeah, and I guess so many people already think that there's too much development there. So I guess why are we adding more?
Well, I think this area has an opportunity to be a real special place. I think housing is always a concern. Brings traffic, brings cars. I think these three spaces, in theory, would bring additional individuals to the area, but I think they would bring them in times that wouldn't be congestion times, or there's just kind of a need for some community spaces in our community. There's land is so valuable, it's critical to have these spaces, and I think if the county can accommodate a nonprofit in this area, it'll just be beneficial to everybody.
Yeah, so if you decided not to allow it, the amendment, would it be left as open space?
Well, those two 10,000 square feet, for example, would be, I think one of them is a 60,000 square foot building that would now be 70,000 square feet. So it wouldn't be, it's not open space. It's going to be a building regardless. So it's just adding that much space. I think for all intents and purposes, if you looked at a 60,000 square foot building or a 70,000 square foot building, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
All right. Let's see. Tomorrow, the county council will begin meeting at noon for a site visit to Junction Commons. This is the former outlet malls for the redevelopment as a mixed-use property, both commercial and residential. So what's the council looking for here on this site visit?
Well, I think we've looked at a lot of maps, and I think we'd like to just actually walk it. I think that the applicant did this with the Planning Commission as well and felt like it was very successful. And so we have a 45-minute walk around there on the actual site. And then later at 2:25, where we are addressing their latest proposal, which is actually quite different than they were proposing before. We haven't seen them for at least a month. And I think they kind of went back to the drawing board based on some feedback from council and have really upped the total affordable units. And actually, I think there's 89 less overall units. So I think they've really listened to council and are trying to find a way to make this project work.
Okay, so it doesn't have to go back to Planning Commission given all of the changes, huh?
No, I don't think so, no.
All right. So when does this redevelopment come back for final approval?
Well, I think it is on there for possible approval this week. I would be, I guess, surprised if we came to a total conclusion, but I think they've really asked us to make a decision soon, and I think the council will do that pretty soon.
All right. Let's see. Later on, the renaming of the Tech Center Drive. Who's requesting this?
Well, it kind of came internally, but it was over a year ago. We went through a public process to rename this road. I think we felt like Tech Center wasn't going to represent the area very well, the name Tech Center Drive. We went through a process, and we landed on Nordic Drive. That was a public process. We had a lot of people vote on that from members of the public. At that time, Six Ridge Partners asked us to just hold off because they were going through a branding process, and they came out with Altus, as we've all heard. So I think we're at the decision-making point where we want to say, do we want to make this Altus Way and go with their branding, or do we want to just stick with Nordic Drive? And I think the council will give us direction on that. We have some plats and some other ways that we need to reflect that name, so we're ready to make a decision there.
Yeah, is there a recommendation?
No, I don't. I think the staff's kind of taken a hands-off approach to that. I've heard kind of both ways that Altus Way would work, but I'm kind of thinking that Nordic Drive might be the winner here. But I think the council will make that decision.
All right, council will also get an update from the Summit County Housing Authority to discuss the draft strategic plan. So, has it been a year already that the Housing Authority has been formed?
It has been more than a year. Yeah. I think it's even been a year and a half. Mm-hmm. We did have some members of the board that had to re-up their terms. They had staggering terms, so they had been in a year. So we did have that happen, and they seem to have done some really wonderful work. And I'm excited to hear from Maddie. It's a meeting that's on my calendar that I have not been able to make one time. So I've been frustrated. I hadn't attend the Housing Authority meeting. So I'm anxious to hear from Maddie and members of the board will be there as well.
So. Okay, so you couldn't say whether or not you're happy with the progress they've made because you don't really know what progress.
That's true, and I have the strategic plan is very very impressive to me. I did review that, and I also have heard just anecdotally that the Housing Authority is really anxious to have a project. They really want to get their hands dirty. And so I think as we've talked about the Klein Dolly development and even this public-private partnership in the Kimball Junction, are there opportunities for the Housing Authority to go through to actually have ownership? We have 160 units in the public-private partnership that the county will own. Is that going to be the Housing Authority that actually manages that for us? I think they would like to do that, and so I think we want to get them a little bit more invested in their actual work.
So when you talk about managing it, they would be, if any rents needed to be collected, or that's...
Yes, and probably not day-to-day as much, but mm-hmm. they would probably supervise maybe a contract of, you know, Mountainlands Community Housing does that for us in Bear Hollow, for example. So that would maybe take that out of the role of the staff and put that in the Housing Authority's to-do list, but again, I don't think we've still not made a lot of the determinations of where the county stops and the Housing Authority starts when it comes to housing. We'd like to really flesh that out, and we may not do that tomorrow, but...
Right. So what will the strategic plan do?
Well, I think it sets up a strategic plan for housing. It's I think it's that too. I think it's also them expressing an interest in being more involved in the housing from the county. And they get grants. But the plan itself is just laying out what the future looks like for the Housing Authority.
Okay, and so once adopted, then what?
Then they continue to go to work. I think they're going to look for a little direction from the County Council, but they meet monthly, and this is just an annual update that I think they're in their bylaws.
All right. Let's see. The certified tax rate has been calculated. Did it come in where taxing agencies in the county were budgeting for?
Well, the rate itself, as you know how this works, as our values increase, our rate actually goes down. So every year the auditor has to set the rate and propose that to council, and they adopt that. Mm-hmm. So we've gone through the valuation process, and the rate is coming down, but that just means we're going to collect the same amount of tax that we always do, because we are not going through truth and taxation, at least not yet. So if we don't go through truth and taxation, that rate comes down. People talk about us having a really low tax rate, but for all intents and purposes, we are still, our valuations are so high that we still pay a lot of taxes here in Southern County, relatively.
Yeah, and as you know, I mentioned, higher property values mean lower tax rates, but it also means what? We've got a bunch more development, or is it just the property is becoming more valuable?
I think it's just the property is becoming more valuable. I'm hearing that we're in a relatively soft market. I think the valuations have gone up much less than they have in the past. The assessor goes through a process where every 5 years they are on site at every property, and so sometimes they hit other properties over years in different ways. Condos might be increased, or commercial might be increased a little bit more than they usually are, but they're usually catching up to actual values. And it's a real challenging process in Utah. We don't have a lot of data that we get from the sales of homes or commercial businesses, so we're usually trying to be pretty conservative with those numbers. But again, this is Cindy Kies and her team in the auditor's office proposing these certified tax rates.
All right. So does it mean that taxes are going down since the values are higher?
No.
Just the rates going down.
Just the rates going down. That's correct. The way it works in Utah is that we're property taxes, we're guaranteed, and it's probably a bad word, but we are guaranteed to collect the same amount of tax year over year.
Okay. Let's see. It looks like in 4 years, the assessed valuation has nearly doubled. Is that all new growth?
No, it shouldn't be new growth. If the valuation's gone up, that would be the values of homes. And I can't speak to that. I don't have that number here with me, but I think double sounds like a lot to me. But values have gone up tremendously since, especially since COVID. I think we've all, that to me was a watermark in probably nationwide, but especially here in values increasing.
All right, because it looked like it was like 50 trillion or something. I mean, okay. Let's see. It was also interesting to read that second homes make up at least 2/3 of Summit County's revenue. Primary homes make up about 26%, businesses 9%. So any surprises there? I guess I was surprised by that number of second homes.
Yeah, I still think that's just incredible. And of course, those primary homes are the ones that get the exemption for the primary exemption, and the rest pay 100% of their taxable value. I'm very surprised by that number. I feel like I haven't heard it to be that. I think I've heard maybe 60%, but 2/3 is, and it feels like it's going down too. I feel like more people are moving here and staying here, and this is their primary home, but it seems like the data would say otherwise.
All right. The County Council will reconsider the 2026 restaurant tax grant application from North Summit Recreation District for new lights. How much is going to be granted, do you know?
I think the proposal is $320,000, something around
328,
that.
$328,000, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they're going to get it all?
I think that's the way the council was leaning last time. This was not on the agenda for action last time, or I think they probably would have mm-hmm. done it then. So this is a very short agenda item, because I think the council has resolved to fund that. I think there was just some concern with maybe a little bit of a misunderstanding between the applicant and the restaurant tax board on what this was. And I also think that the council, we have a a little bit of a balance, and you shouldn't say a little bit, it's actually $4 million in restaurant tax. So I think there's enough funds there that the council felt like the cause was just here with the Beacon Hill complex.
Okay. At 5:30, a public hearing on the 910 Ranch Recreation Management Plan. This is ready to go?
It is. There's really nothing new from when Jess presented to us a couple of weeks ago. This also was not stylized to have any public comments, so we're just wanting to hear from the public on the management plan. We have heard some since her presentation, and this is just a public hearing to have people come and speak about it positively or negatively. And I think we have heard from all interested parties here, from those who don't want, you know, any humans on this property at all, to those who want to just run all over the place, and I think we're trying to land somewhere in an appropriate place in between.
Okay, and I think the recreation plan is one of just, what, four plans or something that she's got working on?
I don't know if it's four, but this is one of several, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I don't think so. You've covered the elections today. I would encourage everyone to get out and vote. And maybe one other thing is that if people have interest in wildfires, they're all over us. We were just talking, Leslie, you and I, just before we started about the smoke here. I think people have questions about that. They can go to summitcounty.info/fire and get information on the fires that are affecting us here. And let's continue to hope for the best and be safe as July gets here.
Okay, Shane Scott, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, Utah is entering the height of wildfire season with fires burning from Weber to Iron County. Summit County has issued a drift smoke advisory. While there are no active fires here in the Wasatch Back, smoke from the Iron Fire in Juab County and fires in nearby states is expected to drift across Summit County this week. The Associated Press reports extreme heat and dry, windy conditions over the weekend fueled several wildfires, some prompting evacuations. The Iron Fire is the largest in the state, burning some 24,000 acres. It remains 0% contained since it was reported June 19th. The nearby town of Eureka's 1,000 residents were evacuated Saturday after the human-caused blaze exploded in size. So far, no homes have been lost. Officials remind residents to only report a fire if they see a defined smoke column or flames. Stage 1 fire restrictions are in effect across the Wasatch Back. The latest fire information is available online at kpcw.org. The Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History will host its third annual Music for the Mines next week, featuring local piano legend Rich Wyman. In the studio from Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History, I have Donald Roll and Alicia O'Meara. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Don, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the Friends group, what it is and what you do.
Well, you know, I'm trying to figure that out, Leslie. we're an all-volunteer committee of the Park City Historical Society and Museum. We were formed a little over 10 years ago by Sally Elliott, and it was a call to action when the Daily West head frame fell down in 2015. And Sally said, we got to save all these mining structures that are at risk. And we have, over the last 10 plus years, we have saved 14 of our mining structures within the Park City Mining District.
Yeah. We raised Daily Head Frame in 22, yep. And we had a really wonderful cocktail party and had everybody over. It was a two-day adventure.
So you have 14 saved. How many more are left to be saved?
Well, our current project is the Thanes Mine, which we just started on this week, and we raised most of the money last year to do that project. And then there are a couple of smaller ones, but there's one really big one, which is the Silver King Mill in Woodside Gulch. And that's probably going to be our next big project. Hopefully we'll start on that next year. We have there's a lot to do there. We need to get the engineering studies done, and secure the place is our first objective.
Okay, so you've raised how much money over this year, 10 years?
Including our community partners, it's approaching $5 million.
Wow.
So that's a lot of money, but it's expensive work.
Okay, Alicia, give us the details of the fundraiser. When and where and how much?
Well, we're at the Pendry, and this was Rich Wyman's idea. He's fantastic. He's got his partner, Eddie Thompson, there, and they do the dueling pianos. It's going to be 6 p.m. July 1st at the Pendry again. It is a fun event. It's dueling pianos. We don't have a paddle raise. We don't have an auction, but we can start and stop songs, and everybody gets excited. There's some dancing. Food's great. It's just an all-around fun event that helps us raise money for the structures.
Okay, the ticket costs how much?
$375.
All right.
And if you buy a table of eight, you get a 20% discount for $2,500.
Okay. So how does the dueling piano part work?
Well, we have song requests on the tables, and we put lists of songs, so if people are trying to figure out what they want to see played, and then they turn it into Rich and they bid on the song. Like, let's say they'll bid $100 or $500. We've had songs go as much for $3,000. So,
what song was that?
I believe is Mustang Sally. So you can also stop a song, which is really fun. If there's something you don't want to hear, you can just stop the song for money too. And it just becomes exciting event.
To stop a song is $1 more than the bid to play the song.
Correct.
And Rich and Eddie play everything. I have never seen them stumped in the 2 years we've been running this. It's pretty amazing, and it's quite good fun.
Yeah, it just goes to show you that great musicians, they can just read the chords, and yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Super talented. Yeah. And a lot of locals come. We have a lot of older locals that have been here forever that come to this event that have been supporting our structures. So it's really a fun locals event.
Yeah, and it's there's no silent auction, there's no long speeches, it's heavy apps, open bar, and Rich and Eddie playing the requests, and hopefully everybody's up dancing. Yes. during the evening. So it's really good fun.
Yeah, our goal is put the fun in fundraiser.
Great. How much do you hope to raise?
Well, last year we did north of $40,000, which was it's our biggest fundraiser. So if we could be north of $40,000 again, it would be great.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Let's talk a little bit more in depth about some of those projects. You mentioned the Thanes Mine. What needs to happen there?
I'm just going to first say we have to thank a few people, though, first. In addition to Rich, the Pendry for hosting us, Russian River Wines, who are providing the wines, Park City Performing Arts for providing us comp tickets to Silver...
On the slopes, the... At Canyons.
I just went, but there's something on the slopes. Getting to our, already this year, this work year, we just finished, we're actually, oddly, you know, we do preservation, but this year we're actually doing demolition. So there's a remnants of a stores building that was in front of the Silver King mine. It used to be 140 feet, then half of it collapsed in 2019. So then it became a 70-foot building. And then in the big snow year of 23, it became a quarter of a building. And then the following year, it became a tenth of a building. So, it's a historic structure. And we got approval from the city to take it down in just a couple months ago. And so that was not only... terrible to look at. It was a hazard to anybody trying to poke around in it. So we took that down. We're now up at the Thanes. The first job is to once again remove the debris from the roof collapse in 2023. So the city and the resort gave us some money to take the roof off. 2 years ago, because it was very dangerous. With the roof collapsing onto the building, and anybody could go in there and seriously hurt themselves. So we took care of that, but there is an incredible amount of debris from that roof collapse. I mean, entire parts of the building are demolished. So we are, Clark Martinez and his crew are right now getting rid of all the debris. And the biggest challenge is not actually just getting it off the building, it's trucking it down from Thanes Canyon. So they're putting dumpsters up by the maintenance building, the Silver King, the Park City Mountain maintenance building, and then bringing all the debris down by pickup truck. which is going to take a while.
Yeah, and we're talking about the building there at the base of Thames Chairlift.
Yes. Okay. Connected to, everybody sees the conveyor belt. It's just behind the conveyor belt.
Okay, so demolition will be done this summer and then next...
Well, hopefully we're going to do that, get that done by July. And then we will, thankfully, the hoist house, which has a lot of equipment in it, the walls are okay. They didn't get compromised in the collapse. So we are going to reinforce those walls and then put a new roof on. And then the second big objective is the shaft area, which has the cages that were used by the skier subway, are currently exposed to all the elements. So we're going to put a fairly substantial awning over that so that we protect it from the weather and also have a viewing area for people who go up there to see the see how people came up from 1,600 feet down to go skiing. It truly is amazing.
Yeah. Okay. You had also mentioned the Silver King Mill. This is just downslope from the work that you did at the head frame there, huh?
Correct, yes. It, as you ski down from either Townlift or Payday towards Bonanza Chair, and if you look left instead of right, you'll see the seven-story mill. And, you know, there's been fires in there, you know, kids have set fires in there and all sorts of vandalism has happened. And that's, you know, that's three times bigger than the mine building. It's seven stories. It's huge. And that's the last of the what I'd call major structures that need to be attended to. And we have absolutely no idea what that's going to cost, but it's going to be a substantial amount.
Right. And what did this building do, all seven stories of it?
Oh, so in essence, what the mine building is where the shaft was. So all of the miners went down, and all of the ore that came out of the mine came up. It was then put on a conveyor belt to the top of the mill, and then it was crushed. The rocks were crushed, and then in essence, through a series of steps, as the gravity brings the ore down, it becomes concentrate that can then be shipped to the smelters to turn into silver.
Right. So from the mill building, then it went right down to town lift area, right?
Yeah, coalition building, which burned down right by town lift. And there was a series of conveyors. And of course, the tramway, which parallels the town lift, was the way that the ore came down.
Okay, and then there was a train depot.
By the depot restaurant.
That's correct.
Okay, let's see. Alicia, tell us how people can get tickets.
They can go on the museum website and go on to events and look up July 1st and go right into that and purchase tickets directly through the museum website.
Yeah, we made it really easy this year. It's parkcityhistory.org.
Correct.
And right on the top of the when you log into the website or get on the website, you'll see a banner for Music for the Mines. You click on that and you can sign up.
It's very easy.
And we're still looking for 30 people. We have 90. Our goal is to have 120 attendees this year.
Okay.
So we need 30 more of you, please,
please
sign up to have fun.
Come join us. We'd love
have
to see you there.
Have fun at our fundraiser.
Okay. Again, that's July 1st, 6 p.m. at the Pendry.
Correct.
Anything else you wanted to mention?
Just, our other big project this year is to launch something called the Historic Mine Route, which is going to be a 7-mile hiking and biking experience where you will learn about our mining history. We're partnering with an app called Travel Stories that will have 24 different audio narratives, 2 to 3 minutes each. And as you approach each of the mining sites, as long as you have the Travel Stories app on, it'll automatically start the narratives. And so this is a way that people can learn while they're recreating more about our amazing mining history. And we will be launching that on Miners Day, September 7th.
Okay, so, but the trails are all done and the
trails are pretty much done. We have a lot of work to do between now and September 7th.
Okay.
But we're confident we'll be ready to go.
Okay.
And we're pretty excited about it.
All right, Alicia, Don, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Leslie. You have a great day.
The Park City Golf Course hosting an open house coming up July 6th to review the proposed golf course master plan for the renovation of the 18-hole course. In the studio with details, I have golf club pro and manager Vaughn Robinson. Good morning. Thanks for being here, Vaughn.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking up the date really quick again. Yeah, it is.
Yep.
It's
Monday, July 6th.
Monday, okay.
Yes.
Where will the open house take place?
So it's going to be in the library community room from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m.
Okay. Again, Monday, July 6th. And where are we in the master planning process?
So kind of a quick timeline was this all was driven by the irrigation system that the golf course needs. It's beyond its expected life. Then we ended up hiring a consultant last year. They came in, listed out a bunch of possible improvements, took that to council, and council decided that, hey, if we're going to look at this irrigation system, it's a perfect time to look into what other improvements could we make at the golf course and, you know, make it a better experience for all those who use it. So we hired a golf course architect, Beto and Boyden, to come in and create a master plan. In that process, we did a survey. We got about 350 responses, right around that number, that were given to the architect so they could really focus in on how extreme do we want to go with this or how subtle do we want to go with this. Seems like everybody is loving the golf course the way it is, so we're not going to blow it up, so to speak, and redesign every hole. It's more, hey, what can we do to make it better? Over the last 50, 60 years, you know, shots out of bunkers have created humps and bumps around the greens, that kind of stuff. Are the greens too severe? Is the difficulty of the golf course too easy, too hard, or just right? And so they took those responses, and they're implementing and their design work with that, and they'll be bringing that back to us, and we should have that design work at the open house.
Okay, so from your perspective, I mean, how could it be made better, the golf course?
So that's a tricky question.
Well, what are people said? I mean, are the greens lame, or are the fairways rough? Or?
So there are some humps and bumps in the fairways, right? We tease about that. And over that period of time that the golf course has been here, the biggest negative is you get a lot of different varieties of grasses growing in. That makes it very difficult to keep a smooth putting surface. It makes it very difficult on the maintenance staff as each grass needs different amounts of water or fertilized differently to try to make it healthy. So that would be really nice in the follow-up of the 2 years or 1 year that it might take to do some renovation work. All of that being consistent, the quality of the product we would give to that user is going to be so fantastic.
Yeah. So where do you expect that most of that work to be done then? On the greens to make sure that the grass is just one time?
Yeah, that's what we're still working on. That's where we're hoping to get a lot out of the survey. The public input opportunity at this open house will be great, to where those who have an opinion one way or another can come in and express that. They can see what the golf course architects come up with, kind of get a better vision of what truly might be going on. I think we all create our own little perception of what's going to happen, and sometimes that's good and sometimes that's bad on what rabbit hole we might end up going down.
Okay. It looked like the survey was still up online. So people can fill it out? Or?
My understanding was it was closed,
okay.
but I might be incorrect in that. So if they go to the golf course website, the link was on there, so they should be able to link it and get in if it's still going.
Yeah, because I did kind of click on to look at what some of the questions you were asking about. I noticed that there were no questions about Nordic skiing, and as we know, that's like at least a third of the year. So why only focus on the 8 months of golf not the entire course,
sure,
which is used for Nordic Center?
When we initially got into this, it was on the golf course. I think in the back of everybody's minds, the Nordic is still involved in that process, even though it's not explicitly listed out. The golf course architect is looking into the Nordic. They are checking with other golf courses. They'll work with the irrigation specialist, assuming we get everything approved, to look at that, make sure that the layout fits, and whether or not their snowmaking would be involved. Council has asked about the snowmaking, so they're definitely looking into that, even though that wasn't initially proposed. We'll work with Nordic as well to kind of see what their expectation or wants are. Are you just trying to have a 3K? Are you trying to get an entire 5K? Do you want the entire golf course? Obviously, that's going to come with way different costs, depending on to what extent you go with that. But that's definitely part of the plan here.
Okay. Do we have any numbers in terms of what it would cost to implement the master plan?
Still guesstimations. We are hoping to get that. Now that they're going to have a design work for this, they'll have a much better idea of these possible improvements and what each one will cost. We will take that to council mid to late August and give those numbers to council, and they'll be able to make a decision on kind of, do we want to do all of it? Do we want to do some of it? Do we want to do none of it? Or exactly where we go in this process.
Yeah, but what is the thinking here, though? Because it would likely, well, I don't know, you could do what Homestead and Jeremy did, just close down, or you could do 99.
Yeah, there would be, those are the two biggest options. The biggest hurdle we have is the growing season here. It's very short. You end up having to sod stuff, which is more expensive, versus seeding stuff, which most of the architects have leaned towards. That actually grows in better than sodding. Less chance of transporting some form of a fungus or anything else that may have grown with the sod somewhere else. So the survey leaned towards 2 years versus 1 year, but everybody's opinion is a little bit different on that one.
Yeah, so have you kind of gone through some of those survey responses? I'm just curious what some of the biggest complaints about the course are.
Unfortunately, I didn't list any of that kind of stuff out, so I don't have a lot of detailed knowledge. There was a lot of responses. Most of the responses that I saw were everybody loves the golf course. Love to see subtle improvements, you know, some leveling of tee boxes, leveling of the fairways. Some people want the greens a little more easy so they don't three putt as frequently, but most people actually enjoy the golf course the way it is and the difficulty it has.
Okay. How would you describe the difficulty of the course? You've played lots.
I would say it's very tricky. The hard part is everybody, especially people that have not played there frequently, all they see are the trees. And the trees line every fairway. It's a short golf course compared to especially anything built nowadays. But that's also the fun of the golf course, right? If you view the trees as kind of shaping the hole instead of a hazard, it really helps on improving your play on the golf course. The greens are tricky. There's two greens, hole number 6 and hole number 14, that really make it hard for us to put a lot of different pins in there. So you get a lot of wear in the same spots. And they're not as fun as the rest of the golf course. So those two would be really nice to rebuild, even if you didn't do the others. But some subtleties, the greens are kind of small. You could make them slightly smaller in a few holes and maybe slightly larger in other holes. Maybe shift them a little bit. You know, with losing some yardage on holes 10, 11, and 12 when the hotel was built, the dog leg of hole number 10 doesn't really fit the original design. So you can shift that and kind of bring it back to how it was originally laid out to be, and more of a playable and fun aspect on that kind of stuff. So there's lots of positives that could come from it. Few negatives, obviously, is you might only have 9 holes for 2 years, or you're shut down for a year. But if you look at the outcome that would be when it's done, and how, you know, 30 plus years of a wonderful golf course that everybody can enjoy.
How could the master plan help with water conservation? Because as you know, you're paying for the water bills now.
Yeah, the golf course is a little tighter, you know, more holes side by side. So there's not a lot of areas to turn into, you know, non-irrigated. But when you change all the golf course heads and use them, they can be more specific on where the water is going. You're more efficient on that. So it's going to be more precise on where the water goes, which should lead to a little less use as far as overall water as well.
And then just replacing the aging infrastructure should help a lot too.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. I guess what should attendees expect then at the open house if they showed up? Is just kind of walk around and just see the different...
Yeah, they'll be able to just come and learn about the project, learn a little more versus guessing on what's possibly happening. We'll love to have their input on kind of what they feel should or should not happen as well.
All right. And then once that master plan, then it goes to council for final approval? Or
yeah.
Or the designers will take it back and try to incorporate what they hear from the public?
Sure. I'm sure they'll make quite a few little adjustments here and there with some more public input. And then, yes, we'll take that to council, especially with the cost, because that's kind of what's going to lead to what may or may not happen is let's see what each of these items would cost. Where do we want to go? What can we keep in-house and have the golf course staff do, which will save some money? And what do we need to hire out, which is obviously going to be a little more expense.
Okay. All right. Again, that's happening Monday, July 6th from 5 to 7 p.m. on the third floor of the Park City Library building. What kind of season have you had so far?
It's been busy. We got an early start, first time ever in March. We did get some weather. Mother Nature, you know, kind of controls all for us. If it's sunny, it's busy as busy. If it rains, it slows everything down a little bit. But overall, the golf course came through the winter very nice, and people are still coming and playing and loving what we got.
Yeah. And is there a problem with slow play on the course? Because I know that was some of the survey questions addressed.
Sure. We did get the new GPS software, which we hope will help speed up play, as everybody doesn't have to go and find a yardage, especially if they hit their tee shot into another fairway. It kind of gives them that yardage. There's always going to be one day. It only takes one group to slow things down, unfortunately, but we do have a player assistant out there trying to herd them along and maintain that. You know, it used to be 4 hours was kind of the expectation, which it still is, but four and a half hours is kind of the accepted level. Very rare that we would ever get to a five-hour round that would really create issues with people.
Okay. And besides kind of the men's and women's tournaments, do you also have outside tournaments that you host?
We have, I call it four and a half, because there's one that's a nine-hole event. So we minimize that. We used to have about 10 or 11. We minimized it down to that four and a half or five events a few years back. And at the moment, that's still the plan, is to just maintain those that are there and keep as many open tee times available for public as we can.
Okay. And then you also offer rentals, lessons, pro shop?
We've got about 50, 60 rental sets, which go out a lot during the days, and lessons are available. The Men's and Ladies League, we have junior leagues on Mondays, so there's pretty much driving ranges open from 7 to 7 every day. So I think we can hit the spot with what most people would like to do.
Okay. How's your game going?
My game's a little on the rough side. I maybe need to practice like I would preach to most people and kind of dial things back together, but there's still some shining moments here and there.
Great. All right, Vaughn, anything else you want to let us know?
No, I appreciate it. Come out and visit us and give us that input. We'd love to hear it.
Okay. Vaughn Robinson, again, is the Park City Golf Club pro and manager. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, after months of declining hotel bookings in the Park City area, visitation has bumped back up. KPCW's Christine Weller reports many are also booking winter trips early.
The Park City area's lodging occupancy in March and April was down nearly 25% year over year. That number spiked upward in May. Occupancy rates rose 22% compared to 2025, according to the Park City Chamber of Commerce and Visitors Bureau. Dan Howard from the Bureau said May occupancy numbers are usually, quote, iffy, as summer recreation activities have to wait for snow to melt. But this year, the snow didn't stick, so locals and visitors started biking and hiking on area trails early. Howard said June numbers are already up 2% year over year.
A lot of people didn't make it for the winter because they just knew the conditions weren't what they wanted, but they do want to be in the mountains. So we're seeing advanced bookings for the summer that are showing year-over-year increases.
Local arts opportunities are also drawing visitors, Howard said, including the Deer Valley Outdoor Concert Series, the Kimball Arts Festival, and Park City Opera Shows. The sixth-month projection is also promising. With local resorts calling this season's lackluster winter an anomaly, Howard said out-of-towners are booking early for winter 2026 to 2027.
People are already betting on it. Like, they didn't get what they wanted last winter, so they're going to, you know, jump on those early bookings. And that's great news because we've got some revenue to make up for.
While occupancy for the past 6 months was down over 12% compared to last year, the next six are up 2%. The average daily rate for lodging is also up 3.7% for the next 6 months at $395. Christine Weller, KPCW News.